Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
And, life still sucks, so not a whole lot to say, right?
Just get used to it, get over it.
Things are bad, like, you can catch cold and die just walking outside. People basically are assholes everywhere,
Which is why you got to tune into the show, because what else are you going to do?
Right, well, this at least concentrates it, right? It isolates the problem.
Oh, you mean because we gather all of the evidence of that?
If you're in here, it's only a certain number of assholes, basically, right? If you're on social media, there's just like an ever-expanding universe of objectionable people, and you don't need that. So in here, there's at most two.
Yeah, at least one, because Matt's always on the show.
Right.
Yeah, and then, depending on my mood and the guests that we have on. But today's guest is not an asshole.
He's not an asshole. He's just smart.
He's just smart, yeah.
So we have a very interesting guest, a mystery guest. We'll talk about that in a bit. We have a lot to get to, so let's just dive right into it. Yeah.
Dive into it, just really important announcement. The lighting in my room is making it look like I had some kind of accident and shaved part of my eyebrow. But I assure you, that's not what happened. It's just a shadow.
She did actually shave one of her eyebrows.
Halfway only, yeah.
Yeah. So she's just saying that to try to...
Pencil it in to make it look...
Yeah, exactly. All right. So four food groups. Democrats suck. Republicans suck. Isn't that terrible? Isn't that weird?
We have a little bit of a tech issue, so we're going to record into my iPad from now on. So apologies.
This episode. Don't worry.
There's a lot of stuff going on this week, but the big political story was the deal that didn't happen. I mean, there's obviously a million things that can happen from now until the election day, but the question of whether or not the Democrats and the Trump administration are going to come together to pass a stimulus bill that will give people relief is probably the biggest single serious policy issue, I guess, that we're dealing with right now, apart from the Supreme Court situation. And Trump kind of he's been all over the place with this. He kind of abruptly pulled out of negotiations with the Democrats a long time ago. Then he went back into them. Then he publicly stopped negotiating again. Then he started doing it again. And now, as of this moment, actually probably the deal will already be done and the money will already be spent by the time the show comes out. But right now, I think it was originally $3.4 trillion. It's now, the proposed number is $2.4 trillion. And that was, I think, the Democratic offer.
Right.
Trump, I think, countered with a much smaller offer beforehand. Then he came up to $1.8 trillion. And they've rejected that number, and the Democrats did. And Nancy Pelosi came under a lot of fire from a lot of different people from all across the political spectrum, including friends of show, Ro Khanna and Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang said, he tweeted, "Nancy Pelosi, take this deal."
Which is like really problematic and misogynist. And a man should never tell a woman what to do because she's a queen.
Who are you doing that?
Just like annoying, knee-jerk, not like a neoliberal feminist voice.
Ah, okay.
Listen to women. Including the ones who create an ineffective opposition to Trump.
Okay, so this became part of the social media joke to this thing that happened. Dan, can we see the exchange between Wolf Blitzer and Nancy Pelosi?
To those people is, we're going to get a deal. And when we do, it will be retroactive. It will be retroactive.
Here's what you wrote in a letter to House Democrats, Madam Speaker. And I ask these questions only, as you know, so many millions of Americans are suffering right now.
Well, you quote two people who know nothing about the agreement.
Well,
there is no agreement. But what the suggestions are, as if there's some authority on the subject. Please, give equal weight to 12, to all of the chairmen on the committee who have written this bill.
But so many of your fellow Democrats in the House, they want a deal right now.
No, that isn't.
The problem solvers. they all want a deal right now. Yeah. And here's what they're complaining about, because you wrote a letter to House Democrats and you said this. Let me read a line from the letter you wrote. The president only wants his name on a check to go out before Election Day and for the market to go up. Is that what this is all about? Not allow the president to take credit if there's a deal that will help millions of Americans right now?
He's not that important. But let me say this.
That's a lie.
With all due respect, and you know we've known each other a long time, you really don't know what you're talking about. If the plural of anecdote is not data, yes, there's some people who said this or that. Overwhelmingly, my caucus wants what is right for the American people. Overwhelmingly, our chairman who wrote the bill, read their statements. They all put out their own statements when they saw what the White House was proposing. So do a service to the issue and have some level of respect for the people who have worked on these issues, written the bill to begin with.
She's lying because, as we know from the Kara Swisher interview that I mentioned last week that I heard via Jimmy Dore, and he played the interview, this is not a question of interpretation, Pelosi says the president just wants to write a check with his name on it. And if that's not important, why does she keep bringing that up? This is obviously to score political points.
But let's not go into that. Yeah, you evidently do not respect the chairman of the committees who wrote these bills.
I respect all of you.
And I wish you would respect the knowledge that goes into getting meeting the needs of the American people. But again, you've been on JAG defending the administration all this time with no knowledge of the difference between our two bills. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to say that to you in person.
Madam Speaker, these are incredibly difficult times right now, and we'll leave it on that note. Thank you so much for joining us.
We'll leave it on the vote that you are not right on this, Wolf, and I hate to say that to you, but I feel confident about it, and I feel confident about my colleagues, and I feel confidence in my chairs.
And it's not about me. It's about millions of Americans who can't put food on the table, who can't pay the rent,
and we represent them. And we represent them. And we represent
these long food lines.
And we represent them.
I know you are.
We know them.
I'm just saying.
We represent them, and we know them.
No, you're a turd.
As we say,
we know them. We represent them.
Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, as they say.
It is nowhere near perfect.
Madam Speaker.
Always the case, but we're not even close to the good.
All right, let's see what happens, because every day is critically, critically important. Thanks so much
for
joining us.
Thank you for your sensitivity to our constituents' needs.
I am sensitive to them, because I see them on the street begging for food, begging for money. Madam Speaker, thank you so much.
Have you fed them? We feed them. We feed them.
We'll continue this conversation down the road for sure. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Nancy Pelosi, I would like for you to reach into your fridge and take out a bunch of your ice creams.
She had great flavors. Yeah, which flavors were?
Chocolate. We know she likes chocolate.
Right.
We feed them. First of all, I don't even know where to start with that. And she says something so dismissive about Rokana. She's like, oh, that's nice. But I'm not sure where to start with that, except for, she has nothing of substance. This is like the rhetorical equivalent of no.
And that's what people were saying. It's like, let them eat claps.
Yeah, let them eat claps and let them eat shredded Trump speeches.
Right. And Brambleberry Crisp and salted peanut butter.
Oh, is that her flavors?
Yeah. So yeah, if you look at the flavor, her ice cream of choice is a brand called Jenny's, and they have some really excellent, really inviting looking designer flavors.
You should just go around giving homeless people little sample spoons of it so they can just taste what happiness tastes like.
Yeah. Are you giving those samples? Because we give them the samples.
Because we give them, yeah. I want to know what flavors they are, though.
Can I just address one brief thing with the Wolf Blitzer situation? So that interview between her and Blitzer turned like remarkably poisonous, like really quickly, right?
Yeah.
And I think what's going on in that interview, because she doesn't do that with in the rare instances where she's interacting with like a conservative interviewer, but I think that she is so used to, you know, getting softballed by CNN and MSNBC and, you know, the New York Times and all these other, you know, sort of traditional kind of mainstream press outlets, that when you have a a newsreader who is doing what they basically any of them would have done maybe 10 years ago and just asked a couple of questions that, like, you know, have a few thorns on them, right? She immediately, you can see it in the video, she immediately takes that as a personal attack, below the belt, you know? And she's mad in a way that is difficult to account for on any like rational level, other than, I mean, yes, maybe like it's true. Wolf Blitzer is kind of stepping out of his lane here, and that's
how could he not? I mean, I think it's
what I'm saying is he's stepping out of character. Like it's you know what I'm saying?
It's not inappropriate. It's just not
appropriate.
Yeah. I would say it's not inappropriate. You're saying
it's not inappropriate. No,
right. It's off brand for him. Yeah.
It's off brand. Right. But she can't. Her brain can't process it. She's so used to getting this other thing.
You know why? She has brain freeze, Matt.
From all the ice cream.
Yeah.
Right. That's true. It does hurt right in that same place.
Yeah, it does, right?
Yeah.
When you eat it too quickly, but it's so good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So this whole thing, you know, it's strange. If you read Pelosi's Dear Colleagues letter about why they said no, it's a little odd because it highlights some things that are, you know, they sound like they make sense. She actually talks about what David talked about last week, which is a lack of OSHA protections.
Right.
But the first thing that she writes as her primary objection, this is her letter. A key concern is the absence of any response and a strategic plan to crush the virus. We cannot safely reopen schools, the economy, and our communities until we crush the virus with the science-based national plan for testing, tracing, treatment, and isolation, and for the equitable and ethical distribution of a safe and effective vaccine once developed. This strategic plan is contained in the HEROES Act. Please see the Energy and Commerce memo, which is attached. And I'm not in a position to evaluate like what those plans are or how effective they could be or anything like that. I haven't studied them at all. But for that to be your primary objection to shut down, you know, nearly $2 trillion in aid at this moment before an election, it feels kind of pretextual, doesn't it? Like they're looking yes. for a reason to say no. And I'm not getting it, frankly. I mean, is it just because they don't want to give Trump the win, or is there something else? Because there could be lots and lots of really serious, like, yes, does it include liability waivers that's going to allow these, you know, companies to get away with all kinds of things in terms of firing people? Maybe it's something like that. But if it was that should be the first thing that you should mention. You know, it's just confusing with the policy. Like, I thought it was very weird when Trump didn't do one of these deals earlier, because he spent all summer getting beat up for not doing enough for people on this front. But why would the Democrats at this late date want to wear, you know, a lack of a deal? Right now, they can pitch it like it's her fault. They're even got Wolf Blitzer
right, exactly,
giving her a hard
right.
time.
Yes, and I think that the Dems could say, look, we got this with, you know, because we care about people, we compromise on this bill because we know that people need, they're too suffering, suffering too much, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to let him take the win for it and Dems take the L for it. Like, we know that Trump's bad on this and Dems are supposed to be better on this. So,
right. Yes, exactly. I don't know. It seems to me that what you would do in this situation is stall a little bit, say no, maybe once, you know, and then say, all right, here's 9 things we got, you know, for stalling.
Right.
Right? And you know, maybe that does include more like child tax credits or, you know, job protections or, you know, more staffing at OSHA, you know, a more coherent vaccine delivery program. I don't know, whatever it is, right? You want to be able to come out and say that you got this.
Right.
But to just be in a position where the no is on you. I'm not getting it right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, it's not good optics or policy, right?
Right, and just to be clear, I thought exactly the same thing about Trump all summer. In fact, I was I was pretty convinced that this was going to be one of the big reasons that he lost
right
in November, was his failure to, you know, to dig deep enough on the individual aid front, right? Because they did do something in the first month. It wasn't a lot, but right. it was symbolically something. And then they kind of just,
yeah, and then they took it as a, then they got to wear that, I mean, use that as a victory, right?
Right,
say that they were taking care of the people. Right. Just want to read this very short thing. Nancy Pelosi on that Swisher interview that I mentioned. Kara Swisher says, where do you press then? When you did the ACA, which I think most people really attribute to your muscling it through, you said you go through a gate. If the gate's closed, you go over the fence. If the fence is too high, we'll pole vault in. If this doesn't work, we'll parachute in. We're going to get health reform passed for the American people. Where is your pole vault here? Where is that for you? And aside from the Republicans, how are you going to use your power to make them do something? And Pelosi says, well, I believe in the American people. They understand people are hurting. We have to meet their needs, not give the president a chance to just say, I'm going to put my name on a check, send it out, and don't talk to me about food, rent, first responders, healthcare workers, the virus, or anything else. That's all he wants, is his name on a check that goes out. And Kara Swisher goes, with all due respect, what's the difference as long as the people get the money? And Pelosi says, no, nothing. Wait a minute. Perhaps I'm not clear. And then she says, state and local government provide everything for us. They're where our services largely come from. If you want to talk about education, we're unhappy about the kind of money and how they want to spend it at the federal level. But that's a small percentage of the money. Over 90% of the money comes from state and local government, which is firing teachers as we speak. Over 1 million, maybe 1.5 million. For public employees at the state and local level have been fired. It could go up to 5 or 6 million people if we don't get this bill. Now those people will lose their jobs. They will then go on unemployment insurance. What's the good of that? Wouldn't it be better for them to meet the needs of people rather than cutting services, raising taxes, firing people, and putting them on unemployment insurance? So we're looking at it comprehensively. You're saying just so they have a check in their pocket, it doesn't matter if they have food and rent. And then Swisher goes, I get that. So what is your pull vote to get there? How are you going to pull vote over this? And she goes, we're just going to keep making our case.
Honestly, I don't get it. Like, they have some leverage in that you can't get this passed without their votes, but they don't have the ability to just ram it through. So the only thing you really have over the situation is a veto. And a veto is what you don't want on an emergency aid package. You know what I mean? Like, you want to make sure that it does go through, but, you know, in the way that you want.
I think it is pretextual, as you said, which I'd never heard before. I like that. Pretextual.
I hope that's a word. It might not be
a word.
I'm
sure it is. No, well, if it's not, we just made it a word. Webster's, look it up, put it in. No, it's just like, I can't stand the reifying of an individual as more important than, like, the yes queen Nancy, you know, clap thing. Like, she's one woman who's extremely rich and powerful. And if you're more offended by a tone that you think Wolf Blitzer took with her, which honestly, I think it's a bit infantilizing. She is the Speaker of the House. I think she can take some of this, all of this. And I think that if a man were talking to Blitzer, he'd say the same thing. And he wasn't making her sound dumb at all. He was just pushing back on her pretty incoherent position. But if you care more about that than all the women who are out there suffering, not provide, you know, not having their needs met, and who Nancy Pelosi is okay, basically, like, throwing under the bus, selling down the river, whatever the thing is, then Nancy Pelosi is perfect for you because it's just performative and substance free. And again, it's right. About like optics and how much this one woman or a handful of women, how much they resonate with you. And that's just like purity, politics, self-indulgent, narcissistic, and not a lot of solidarity in that.
Look, she's yet another prominent major party leader who's worth $100 million+. Incidentally, how, right? Like, there, you know, well, a lot of that money has been made since she was in office, which I really wonder about. And there was a time in American history, like not that long ago, I think you can go back to probably the Clinton years, and, you know, the bulk of people weren't aware of how rich politicians got in this country. I think some people were sort of dimly aware that when presidents left office, you know, like Gerald Ford, they would join the boards of big companies and play golf once a year and get paid ridiculous salaries. Everybody kind of understood that. But now people are very very aware of how wealthy these politicians are. And it's just a really bad look when, you know, I think it really hurt Hillary Clinton in 2016, you know, when they asked her that question, like, why did you take all that money? And she said they offered it. Like, it just rubbed people the wrong way. And right. Now we're in the middle of this pandemic. And I think a lot of these politicians, they've been in this, you know, world for so long where they're, for them, all of these questions are kind of theoretical, right?
Right.
Like, you know, we have to play this out politically to make sure that, you know, we come out ahead. But, you know, for a lot of people, it's urgent. It's like, you know, we need the money, you know, tomorrow. It doesn't matter whose name is on the check.
Right.
Or, you know, the student loan situation. Like, we need the student loan forgiveness. We can't argue about what the long-term impact of that is going to be or whether that's going to create a moral hazard or whatever it is. Like, they need that, you know, right now. But that's not the case, you know, for a lot of these politicians. Same thing a little bit with the police. You know, we're seeing that, you know, in Minneapolis, where a lot of people who were in favor of the strongest reforms were living in neighborhoods that just don't really, you know, have police or need police, right? And so that's another thing that kind of looks weird to ordinary voters. I don't know. I think it's a miscalculation. It's not like Trump is sensitive to the needs of the ordinary person either. Clearly doesn't particularly give a shit.
Like, that's always a thing where people, and this is what Dems live off of, and they're not used to being challenged, and this is why she freaks out. Because again, and even with this, like, she pivots to Corona. So Wolf Blitzer says, Madam Speaker, they really need the money right now, and even members of your own caucus.
Yo, Rokana, that's nice, she says.
Yeah, even members of your own caucus, Madam Speaker, want to accept this deal, $1.8 trillion. Congressman Rokana, for example, wait a second, let me just quote Rokana. Manny Noel, I assume you admire him. No. He's a Democrat. He just said this. He said, people in need can't wait until February. $1.8 trillion is significant and more than twice the Obama stimulus. Make a deal, put the ball in McConnell court. And then Blitzer says, what do you say to Rokana? What I say to you is, I don't know why you're always an apologist. And many of your colleagues apologize for the Republican position. Rokana, that's nice. That isn't what we're going to do. And nobody's waiting till February.
I mean, this is the same. It's the same line as their Twitter fame or whatever.
Yeah, the green new dream or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So I would imagine the end game to all of this is that Trump is going to end up fucking this up somehow. But for now, it's just a very perilous thing for them to be playing around with. They really can't lose this election if they don't do something incredibly stupid between now and November. I don't think.
Right. Right.
But this is in the area of something that could go badly, you know? So anyway, that was funny. All right. For Republican Suck this week, Trump keeps doing this. But if we could see the new ad that they did, which I'm going from memory. I can't remember what the ad is called, but it's something like the awesomeness of America can't be denied and you're an asshole if you do or something like that. I mean, that's not the real title, but whatever it is, could we see it?
Say what you will about America, but don't bet against us. We fight, we move forward, we pay any price. Impossible.
Jackie Robinson.
We treat that
MLK.
As motivation. If it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing. We think big and we work big.
Mount Rushmore. Building Mount Rushmore.
Because we're Americans. Daring. Courageous, loyal.
Firemen.
Our reach always exceeds our grasp.
What's that?
But we get the job
That's
done.
Armstrong's
We got each other's back. And we love a good comeback story.
Famous kissing, returning
push
soldier.
This economy to greater heights. Some folks
the Bull of Wall Street.
They don't believe in America. They want to destroy our traditions, terrorize our community.
Free shit for everyone.
Burning flag.
But we'll never surrender America. Don't bet against us.
if you can't guess the punchline of this, some of the folks who are in this ad probably aren't stoked to be in it. And so I think it is Jackie Robinson's daughter ended up protesting that Trump had stuck an image of her father essentially in a campaign ad. And this is like a longstanding tradition of politicians who do this. They like, they kind of sneakily get somebody to act like they're endorsing the politician. I think the most famous example of this was back in 1988 when George H.W. Bush was using Bobby McFerrin's song "Don't Worry, Be Happy" as his campaign song, which was offensive on two counts because he was using the song to make a political statement that I'm pretty sure Bobby McFerrin didn't want him to make, which was like, we shouldn't worry about stuff. Things in the Reagan years are going great.
Right.
And then, you know, secondarily, he was implying that Bobby McFerrin himself was a fan of Bush. And that ended up being a big brouhaha.
Oh, but did it? He spoke back about it?
Yeah, McFerrin did. McFerrin was not happy about the whole thing. So that keeps happening. Like, artists keep getting sucked into these things. But poor Jackie Robinson, in addition to everything else, you know, like from beyond the grave ending up being stuck in a Trump ad.
Right.
That's pretty bad.
Neil Young had that, right, with the song that Trump used.
It's not big on the list of Trump offenses, but it's interesting because Trump just keeps doing this stuff. He keeps sort of like faux enlisting people to his cause who really aren't fans of his.
Oh, you know who we should get on is Robin DiAngelo, because she can explain to us how the lesson of Jackie Robinson as taught is that
he was the first black player to
break the color line, and that
to be able to succeed on the level of white ball players, right? To play, I have to find that exactly what that
and it's
quote was,
and it's but. That the way it's taught is that he was so good, and there hadn't been anyone as good before.
Yeah, that was basically her thesis, and where she's saying what we should say is that Jackie Robinson is the first black man who was allowed to play by the white man, which is exactly the way it is taught to everybody.
Right. But it's literally the way that like very mainstream places teach it.
Right. And then she was saying that, you know, the story of Jackie Robinson should be a story about privilege. And actually it's probably the first story that most white people associate with privilege because it's the one that's most comprehensible because
the other guys, the white guys, were so much worse. So many white guys were worse than
him. Well, I mean, there was like an outfielder who had one arm who was playing in the major leagues back then. Right. I think actually Professor Horn brought this up. A lot of mediocre ball players who wouldn't have survived, you know. So yeah, she really kind of anti-nailed that one. But I think we should have a little just quickly. We should have a pool and try to guess which person Trump is inappropriately going to draft
next
into his campaign ads.
Let's see.
I'm going to go with Huey Newton. That would be a tough one for him to pull off, but he probably could.
Maybe what would be really interesting is if he went full circle and mentioned someone from the Exonerated Five.
Oh, right. Yes.
That's like the least likely, maybe.
Yeah, that would be. Yeah. He could Photoshop himself, you know, in a group photo with all of them.
With them, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about if you got Sister Souljah?
That would be good. Who's a good feminist author?
A feminist author who critiques Andrea neoliberalism Dworkin. And Joe Biden, right? Liza Featherstone?
Yeah. Liza Featherstone? Mm-hmm.
We could make a video for him if we wanted to.
Yeah, it would be like a We Are the World type of thing.
Yes.
We are Trump's world.
Yeah, we are Trump's world. Or what was that Hands Across America, Arms Across America thing?
Yeah, Hands Across Trump. That would be
hands
good.
Hands Across Trump's America.
Yeah. Well, we got to get all those people together in one shot and see who will volunteer to do a pro-Trump ad. I think it would be kind of funny, actually.
I think we should just make it without their permission, like Trump did.
It would be funny,
actually. How funny would that be?
What song would they be singing? They'd be singing something really like you know, like Pharrell Williams' happiness song, something like that. Yeah,
Actually, what I heard automatically without even thinking, it was like a parasympathetic, it was like synaptic, presynaptic, was the Jerusalem song from that Carrie Simon did in Working Girl. Guys, if you're watching the show, we want you to help us out. Make a montage of all people, of all these people who have said critical things. If you have video of it, that's even better. But if not, you can just write it out. Like activists.
I just want them each to have solos, kind of like in We Are the World, right? But you know, like with where Rachel Maddow would have to have her hands over the earphones, you know what I mean? And belting out how much she loves Trump. That would be that could be really fun.
It's easy. We just take the video they already did for
the song would be called So Much Winning.
So Much Winning. Yes. Yeah. And all we have to do is This Is My Fight song. They've done that already. Do you remember
this
that? This Is My Fight song, which Shalala played in the halls of Congress, but also all these actors did this in 2016.
Right, right. Remember? Yeah. Kind of they're going to have to do it again. All right, what do we have for
Isn't That Terrible?
Isn't That Terrible.
So for Isn't That Terrible, we have something that I saw popping up. All right, so if we could just go to this article at BGR. All right, so you hate to see it, or you love to see it. A venomous caterpillar is invading Virginia. A hairy venomous caterpillar is invading Virginia, and it might make you throw up. Touching the caterpillar puts you at risk of a rash, fever, and even vomiting. And it's native to southern states, but isn't typically found in Virginia. And then I'm just going to go on reading. If we could scroll down a little bit. Some people don't like bugs. That's totally understandable, as many bugs are kind of creepy, slimy, or otherwise off-putting. There's a species of caterpillar in the U.S. that might initially seem strangely cute. And Matt, you and I should litigate that shortly. But its name and the pain it can inflict are more than enough reason to steer clear on it. It's called the pus caterpillar. And if you touch it, you're in for some serious discomfort. How does this work, you ask? It's covered in hair, making it look particularly odd, but that hair hides a painful secret. The hairs hide venomous spines that can inflict serious pain, as well as a host of other symptoms that sound absolutely terrible. So what they recommend is that you don't try to kill it. You should just let nature take its course. But if you do have physical contact with them, here's what you can expect. A rash, itching, which is fine, but other things are fever, inflammation of glands, and vomiting. Somewhere else I read that it was a grid-formed rash, which is actually kind of weirder.
So it's a hairy caterpillar that gives you a rash.
Yeah, I have to admit, the original headline, which I can't find now, was vomit-inducing caterpillar, which was a lot better than a venomous caterpillar. These people do not know how to do SEO.
I mean, if they really wanted to do deadly vomit-inducing caterpillar, deadly naked vomit-inducing caterpillar.
Also, can we talk about the way it looks? I mean, it is cute, but what's the first thing you think of when you see this?
A hedgehog.
Interesting. I thought wig.
Oh.
I thought like wig on the side of the road, or like wig on
like a toupee.
Yeah, like a toupee with like a mullet toupee with a rat tail or a mullet.
Like a Joe Dirt kind of a thing?
Yes. With also with some highlights in it. You got like two parts of it that are highlighted. So the thing is like a brown, it's kind of an auburn haired vomit inducing caterpillar.
It's got the Leonid Brezhnev eyebrow thing going for it too, a little bit.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. On the top?
I mean, the whole thing.
One eyebrow. I see, you're right.
Yeah, if you had two of those.
Right, you have one Brezhnev. Right, you're right.
One Brezhnev. It doesn't have enough bright colors on it. Like, I think, to be fair in nature, if you're going to be poisonous, you should have, like, bright red or yellow in there.
Yeah, and so basically this caterpillar, it's the more I'm looking at it, the more adorable it becomes, but it's a coward liar.
It's a coward liar.
It's using a sneak attack. And they're not shark level bad at all. I don't want anyone to think that's my point. They are kind of cute. Also kind of looks like a turkey.
How many of those do you think would fit in a blender?
I don't think we can say that unless we know the dimensions of it. And it's not giving us the context.
It looks like it's about the size of a of like a dime, maybe, which means you could probably fit a hell of a lot of those.
And then what would you do with it?
Blend.
Right. But then you blend and then what?
I didn't really give it to someone. My thinking.
You put it into a chalice, and you hand it to someone at dinner.
You could fill a balloon with it and then get a bunch of firecrackers, like an M80, and tie it to the balloon and blow it up.
And then let it have, or you could leave it. You know what you should do? You should, what's the thing they do with like poop and bags? They leave it on it. You leave it in front of
set it on fire. Yeah. Not, and leave it. Ring somebody's doorbell.
Yeah.
But then they would get poison all up and down their feet.
Well, that's a, I thought that was the point. I thought you were trying to be nefarious in this sense.
No, I'm just.
Oh, you're just being one of those sick sociopaths who likes to torture animals without.
Caterpillars, not cats or, you know.
No, it's a, right. It's not a cat or dog thing, but that's the only way I could respect you is if you had a target in mind, which would mitigate the sadism.
Look, I draw the line at frogs. Like, I wouldn't do the Beavis and Butthead thing where you throw the frog up in your head with a baseball bat.
That's
but I could
awful.
Definitely, I could definitely fill a blender with hairy caterpillars. I could do that.
I couldn't.
You couldn't do that?
In self defense, if someone was coming after me,
I had a heads up
about it, and I could run. Or if I was in my home and it was like a scream situation, and they were in my house. If I kept a pouch of hairy caterpillars and I could just throw them in the blender and then
just if there happened to be one nearby.
No, you know what I need to do? I need to order some hairy caterpillars, but only when they're dead, as long as the venom works when they're dead. So I'm really hoping it does because I don't want to hurt the caterpillar. So when a hairy caterpillar dies of natural causes, I would like to have them, if anyone out there can do this, send me a box of naturally dead hairy caterpillars. I'll pay for it. We can work that out. I can Venmo you. I'm going to blend them and keep them, that blend, in my refrigerator so it's ready to go. And I'm going to make a flask of it. So when I'm out, once post-COVID, if I'm out and about, I won't have a blender on. Instead of, it's like my, it'll be my mace, my personal mace.
I see. Okay, that's mace. Interesting. You may make a little flask out of it.
Yeah, or a spray. Yeah. I'll put into a spray bottle. So you know what? This started as, isn't that terrible? But I'm going to say, doesn't that have a lot of potential?
Doesn't that have, that's more where the question is here. Yeah,
isn't that potentially?
We started in one place, we ended at another place. Yeah. Okay, I like it. All right, excellent. Isn't that weird this week? This was actually a popular news story around the world, believe it or not. Dan, if we could see the BBC broadcast about this incident. Before we start, see how many puns you can catch.
Okay.
Because this is, again, I know I'm a sucker for this. I love TV writing. Like, but because you can't be too hokey with the TV writing. But you only have like six sentences, right? So you just got to go for it with every one. See how many you can find in this broadcast.
Taking your kids to the zoo should be an educational experience, a chance to get familiar with some exotic animals. But I'm sure parents weren't expecting those lessons would extend to teaching their youngsters profanities.
No puns.
Five African grey parrots were adopted by the Lincolnshire Wildlife Park in August and placed in quarantine together. But when they moved into the main outdoor aviaries, they started swearing at visitors, which has ruffled a few feathers in bees.
Yes.
That's one.
Yeah, action was swiftly taken. They've now been moved into different colonies away from delicate ears.
Yeah, apparently this park is no stranger to bird controversy. It's also home to the parrot that went viral on social media with his version of Beyoncé's If I Were a Boy.
Great song.
If I Were a Boy.
Honestly, the things people tweet these days.
Seriously?
I'm here all night.
You went there?
it's debatable whether they're making a bird pun or not, but the things people tweet these days and ruffled feathers. So this story was all over the place, and that ruffled feathers line was all over the place.
Right.
It was like, in just FYI, what this story is about is a bunch of African grey parrots who... I guess individually were raised in different places and individually learned their own profanity, in each one of these places, then were quarantined in the same room and began swearing at each other. Then they were shown to people at a zoo, began swearing at the people in the zoo, which prompted the zoo-goers to swear back at the parrots, which taught them more profanity.
Right.
So they learned more profanity. They learned it, each learned individually from their owners, then from each other, then from the zoo-goers. And they all ultimately had to be separated. So it's a pretty funny story. As these stories go, it's pretty good.
It's like a reproducing, it's like a monster reproducing or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's an uplifting story in a lot of ways. Like everybody all around the world was using the same language. Dan, if you can see, CBS did a write-up. Five parrots separated at British Zoo after encouraging each other to curse profusely at guests. That's a good headline. It's evocative. Got the rare adverb use in the headline, which is great.
Profusely.
When a parrot tells you to fuck off, it amuses people very highly, he said. It brought a big smile to a really hard ear. Still, keepers thought it would be best to keep them away from children so not to ruffle any feathers. This one's good because another great news trope is that when the subject matter is corny enough, you can do something blatantly corny with the illustration. With the parrot with the voice box and sort of the implied profanity coming out of his mouth.
The hashtag, the asterisk, the ampersand, the at, the exclamation points in the quote.
Right. Yeah. Zoo removes parrots from display after birds keep cursing at visitors. Weak compared to the profusely one. This author, Scott Stump, I got to buy this guy beer if I can find him anywhere. This guy did three paragraphs to open the story, three separate bird puns. It starts off, Polly want to stop cursing?
That's great.
It's great, right? A British zoo has removed a group of parrots from public view because birds keep letting the cuss words fly.
Very good.
That's good, right?
Yeah.
I like it.
We got two sentences and two puns.
Right? He's hitting to all fields. Third paragraph. The Lincolnshire Wildlife Park said they moved the five gray African gray parrots into aviaries away from public view after the nonstop profanity ruffled some feathers.
There we go. That's an 100% sentence to pun ratio or one to one. Yeah. What kind of drink are you going to buy him, Matt?
What would be the appropriate drink? What's a bird themed drink?
I can't think of that. Flamingo? Is there something?
Yeah, there's I think there is a flamingo themed drink, right?
Dove, Paloma, Paloma. Paloma is a mezcal. I think it's mezcal based, and Paloma means dove in Spanish. Boom.
I'll buy it for him. Yeah, yeah. Whatever. Look, that should go in a museum of Leeds.
Yeah.
That's like journalism 101. So good job, Scott.
Yeah.
If that's really your name.
Bad job, illustrator.
Anyway, all right. Well, we're very glad for those African gray parrots that they created so much hilarity and we hope that they continue to tell people to fuck off because we need people to smile during these difficult times and we need to give work to journalists who make puns. So
yeah, and they need to chirp truth to power.
All right. Moving along.
All right. Our guest for this week is somebody who's one of my favorite writers and thinkers, Antonio Garcia Martinez. Kind of an unusual biography for somebody who I'm a fan of because he worked at both Goldman Sachs and Facebook. But he's a brilliant guy, author of a really terrifically funny memoir about Silicon Valley and his experiences there called Chaos Monkeys. And we have him on this week because for a couple of reasons. Number one, one of the bigger stories from a couple of years ago, the Cambridge Analytica story, kind of had a denouement this week because a British regulator, the ICO, has come out with a detailed report that essentially debunks a lot of the crazy, wild, speculative theories about how impactful this group, Cambridge Analytica, was on the American election. It also completely debunks the idea that it had any impact on Brexit. Apparently that there was none of that at all. And the Russian involvement was also severely downplayed in this new British regulatory report. And Antonio, a couple of years ago, was one of the few tech insiders who wrote a piece basically saying, like, look, there's less to this than meets the eye. But of course, he was ignored, as often happens in these kind of media tornadoes that we're involved with now. So that plus the ban of QAnon by Facebook, wanted to not talk about that so much, but about the challenges of policing the internet as viewed from by somebody who knows what it looks like to look at the dashboard of users inside of a company that big. So without further ado, let's talk to him. So we welcome to Useful Idiots Antonio Garcia Martinez, who is one of the few guests who genuinely intimidates me. He's actually worked in a lot of the companies that I've written uninformed broadsides about. He's an insider who knows everything about the tech world, studied physics, worked at Goldman Sachs, if I'm not mistaken. Is that true?
Yes, that's his job.
Just generally knows a whole lot about a lot of things. And we wanted to have him on to talk about a couple of things in particular that are in the news this week, including one story that he played a little bit of a role in because he was an early critic of some of the news coverage that came out, and that's the Cambridge Analytica story that broke a couple of years ago. Antonio, you wrote a book that I first found out about you reading your book Chaos Monkeys, which by the way is a hilarious book, very surprisingly to me. I didn't know who you were, and it was just an extremely funny book about life inside the tech world. But from that book, you talk about your experience with what is and is not effective in terms of data gathering in companies like Facebook. And from that, I gather that the claims of a company like Cambridge Analytica about its magical ability to both attract, to identify people who are going to vote a certain way and influence them might have been a little bit overblown. And you wrote about this a couple of years ago. Can you talk about your initial reaction first to the Cambridge Analytica story?
Yeah, Matt. I mean, not to toot my own horn, I was not only involved in that story in terms of debunking a lot of the original story narrative, I was actually involved in developing the technology that actually was used to do a lot of the targeting.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And that's why I was so pissed off about it, because I felt I had some small stake in it, and yet the story was being misreported. So the Cambridge Analytica story, which of course in the eternal now of the internet feels like ancient history ago, although of course this whole thing has unfolded.
It was 2 years ago, right?
It was 2 years ago. It's nothing. It's nothing.
It was like 20 years ago on internet.
Right. It feels like 20 years ago. Exactly. So the story there was that there's a marketing company called Cambridge Analytica in the UK that made much of its ability to target users on Facebook and elsewhere. And it was sort of supposedly implicated with early on the campaigns of Ted Cruz and eventually potentially the Trump campaign in 2016. And they made very large claims about the ability to psychologically profile Facebook users and send them targeted advertising. And in the sort of hubbub and ruckus of the 2016 election, they became sort of one of the boogeymen in the story around Facebook having gotten Trump elected effectively.
Just to interrupt, they were accused of improperly accessing reams of Facebook data, and then there was this like secret sauce that they were accused of having that allowed them to target people, right?
Right. The improperly accessed part is actually a correct part of the story. And just to be clear, I think Facebook does bear some blame in all this. I'm not saying it's a completely made up story. So just to summarize the story in like 30 seconds. Does everyone remember back in the day when like you used to see all the Spotify listens on your Facebook feed and stuff, or like you would log into Facebook to all these other things and then you'd get like spammed with this shit in your feed and it would just be terrible, right? That was this thing called Facebook platform, which now we're really going back into the midst of time. And I get into a lot of my book because it was part of Facebook's monetization strategy around 2012, 2013.
And you had Facebook ads, right?
Right. Yeah. It all failed. It was a terrible failure. But what it meant was that you could run a Facebook app, meaning an app running inside the Facebook ecosystem that if a user opted into it, that app would have access to some of your Facebook data, under a permission scheme. But of course, everyone just clicks yes to those permission things and whatever, right? So what Cambridge Analytica did was it launched, one of these cutesy political poll type things that we've all done, right? And then it paid people to take them. And when you would take the poll, it would access your Facebook data. And what they were doing is coming up with a correlation model between presumably your political proclivities around various issues, immigration, left versus right, whatever, and your Facebook likes and your Facebook profile. That was in theory the model they were coming up with. Then and again, that was a misuse of the data, and Facebook should have put a stop to it, and they didn't, and that's a real part of the story. What came after, though, was that they built a model that, based on that, so they know, like, if you like, whatever, Burberry and BMW and Lady Gaga, you're more likely to vote X versus Y on some issue, or at least that's the thought. They then, you know, want to run a campaign for X versus Y, and they go ahead and target Burberry, Lady Gaga, whatever. It's a very simplistic view of the world via Facebook's own targeting system, which is one of these things that I worked on in my book. One of the first products I launched at Facebook was this topic targeting system that used your Facebook data to supposedly figure out what you were into.
Was that Project Chorizo or Chorizo?
That was part of it. Yeah, there was a project, Chorizo obviously being a Spanish sausage, in which we would try to take in various pieces of user data. It was a short-lived project, and figure out which one actually boosted ads performance. Almost nothing does, and that's a bigger conversation we can
get into. Right, that's what I wanted to get into. Yeah.
Okay. What Facebook data actually drives ads performance is not. It's a lot less than you think. But just to finish the Cambridge Analytica thing, they then used that model to then target ads, and that was it. And they made a lot of claims about it, which, if you spent any time in ad tech, you will have grown deaf listening to dozens of pitches from all sorts of companies claiming all sorts of things, most of which are not true. But as I say in Chaos Monkeys, in advertising tech, you know, just because it doesn't work doesn't mean you can't sell it, right? And so Cambridge very clearly sold it and found, you know, their biggest act of salesmanship, I think, was convincing journalists that their technology was amazing, right? More than anything else. But
there's a couple of things that are sort of pressure points to the story. First is that they have the ability to what is it called? Psychographing?
Psychographics, yeah.
Right, so psychographics. So the whole concept was, I think they were looking, with the acronym was OCEAN, right? They were trying to identify openness, congeniality, neuroticism.
Extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, yeah.
Right. Through some combination of likes. So if you liked certain things, right, you were supposed to have higher or lower scores on each one of those things. And then, so to me, it's already a little bit specious that you can make a lot of conclusions about each of those things based on Facebook's likes. I mean, you have to prove a lot to get to there. But from there, they also claimed that once they knew that, they would be able to target and convince the political voter, right? Which seemed like that's like a bunch of bridges to cross just to get to reality, right?
To the ocean.
Matt, an ocean to cross. I mean, Matt, you put your finger on it. I mean, I had a piece in Wired that came out called the something specious something of psychographics. And that's the problem, right? They're making a jump from a very vague five-dimensional personality model to a set of political beliefs, to a set of Facebook likes, to then running ad creative targeted against those Facebook likes, hoping to convince you. It literally is something like 3 or 4 week models chained in a row. And yeah, that itself that's the problem right there.
Yeah, if people want to go back and look, the piece is called The Noisy Fallacies of Psychographic Targeting. And that was from March of 2018.
And just to be clear, psychographic sounds like this really,
CIA-ish.
CIA-ish solid social science thing. It is a marketing gimmick. It's a meme that's been floating around the marketing world for a long time. I think it was coined, there's this thing called the prism segments, which is something like, supposedly it bucketizes the entire US consumer population into something like 80 to 100 buckets, including such ones as, I think, shotguns and trucks, or, lattes and liberals or something. You know, it's these very sort of cutesy names that brand marketers, who, shall we say, are not the most quantitative marketers in the history of marketing, use to basically justify the budget that they spend. And so that's where the psychographic thing comes from, just so that the audience is not deceived that it's some sort of real psychological model of human behavior. It is itself a marketing gimmick.
Basically,
go ahead. I just want to make sure people know what OCEAN stands for. I want to make sure we get it right. And then maybe you can Antonio, quiz us or something, or diagnose us. So OCEAN is openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And what's interesting is apparently people with a looser gait tend to be more agreeable.
A looser gait?
Yes.
To be clear, so OCEAN, I'm not a psychologist, so I can't opine on the psychology. I think OCEAN is actually a semi-valid model within the world of psychology. When I say psychographics, it's this notion of like bucketizing users into very vague categories, which apparently they're boosting it with this OCEAN thing, which maybe has validity or not. I can't comment. But in the marketing world in general, this notion of trying to use psychological traits for targeting is not something that is really used broadly within the industry, nor something that people spend a lot of time thinking about, to be honest.
So basically they're arbitrarily making up categories of people and trying to sift them into those categories, which is two different things, right?
Right.
So and that could be, I mean, they probably don't do that, but something like security moms or, upscale suburban people with kids or something like that, right?
Okay. And then trying to find them on Facebook via the targeting system, right? Which is the hard part. That's the next step, right? I mean, I don't doubt that you can probably come up with a correlation between some psychological model and political views or something. There's no question you can probably do that. But then to jump from that to a set of likes and then to use the Facebook targeting system, which is heavily like-based, at least part of it, to then try to target those same people, there's just too many leaps there to really work in any realistic way.
And you wrote about this in your book too. I thought this part was really interesting because I think people make a lot of assumptions about exactly how useful that data. I mean, clearly it's useful, but it's also a lot more confusing than you would think, right? You take the example of listening into like every bar conversation in the world at once, and let's just say you're trying to pick out the name Barack Obama, and you do, but that's not going to be a list of Democrats necessarily, because the word before it might be fucking, right? Or there might be, as Katie was talking about off the air, it might be there might be sarcasm in the statement, right?
Right. I mean, that fucking comment you meant is not just like a rhetorical flourish. We actually had a filter that would actually remove what came after, because obviously it was negative sentiment, right? I mean, it's hard to programmatically detect human sarcasm. There's just no way to do it, right? Right. I think this gets into the bigger issue. And I think this is one of the big misconceptions around Facebook that I was trying futilely to remedy with my book, which is around how does your data get used to monetize yourself, right? Do we want to go into this? I mean,
Yes, absolutely. You know, yeah. I love this. Okay. Unless you have an NDA issue, you don't, right?
Oh, no. I mean, look, if I'm still alive after publishing that book, then I think I'm probably cool at this point. So I haven't been whacked yet. actually, you know, Facebook wouldn't kill you. They would just delete your Facebook account and consider that equivalent to death.
Well, because they literally think that, right? When you come into the company, you have your faceversary.
Right. Yes. Right? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you leave, they have like these Kevlar balloons.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very funny.
When you
like
leave,
the Mylar ones. Yeah.
When you What's leave, that? They
Sorry,
have
Mylar. Yes.
No. When you on your face diverse, a lot of startup companies do this, but Facebook took it particularly seriously. That you get balloons and stuff on your desk when you join the company. That was kind of your
metaphorical your birthday, birth, basically.
Right. But what happens when you leave?
Oh, nothing. Well, I mean. Usually, there was a lore around that. You would post a photo of your Facebook ID along with some long rambling weepy essay about why you're leaving the company or whatever. That was
like a suicide note, basically, right? Yeah.
A lot of these companies, and Facebook and Goldman reminded me of each other a lot. Goldman, what it would used to do, I was on the quant side, which is like the researchers building the models. Mm-hmm. They would publish papers, and if you left the company, they would take your name off the paper. And it got to the point that some papers had no authors, right? It's as if you literally didn't exist anymore. The paper had written itself because literally everybody had left the firm, right? So it's at these companies, it's like they create this all-encompassing world that you live in. And this is very powerful, by the way. Like, we're laughing, but it makes them very effective. But once you leave that world, it's as if you're dead to that world. So
that is really funny.
Yeah. But getting back to the Facebook ad targeting thing. So here, how to best explain it. So here's one way to think about it, right? Everyone thinks Facebook sells your data, which isn't really true. Facebook doesn't really sell your data. In many ways, it actually buys your data by offering advertisers tools and experiences that convinces them to share them being just to name random names, Home Depot, REI, Amazon, whatever, to share the data they have on you with Facebook. The reality is that most data that you inject into Facebook, things like conversations with your partner, photos of you at a party, really have no commercial value. I mean, you can come up with just those stories that say, you and I are talking about my cat, who's you might hear meowing in the background, and suddenly you come to the conclusion that show the guy a cat food ad or whatever. But the reality is that the number of times you actually mention commercial content in a conversation anywhere is not as high as you'd think. And even then, getting the sentiment around that actually would be really difficult. And so, if you sat there and studied Matt Taibbi or Antonio Garcia forever, you could probably come up with some model to do it. But again, any idea you come up with has to work for almost 3 billion people who are on Facebook at scale, right? And Facebook just does not have infinite resources to sit there and figure out your every conversation, right? And so what typically happens, a lot of the data that's used, that you consider, sketchy or scary that, you know, is this hyper-targeting, which is real. And this is part of what I worked at Facebook as well. It's called custom audiences, if you want to Google it. Basically, you go out into the world and you use your Safeway or whatever local grocery discount card with your phone number, for example. You sign up for an email newsletter or whatever. There's various keys that are keyed to your identity, your phone number, even your address in the direct mail world. People don't understand, but the direct mail advertising world is still a multi-billion dollar business. And all of this was, by the way, stolen from the direct mail world. They've been doing this sort of hyper-targeting much, much longer than Facebook has. And so there's a whole world, there's an ocean of data out there keyed by things like email, address, name, phone number, et cetera, right? What those advertisers can do is effectively, I mean, often literally upload spreadsheets with your personal information to Facebook. And that's done in what's called hash space. So there's a mathematical function that happens. Facebook doesn't get the data, but they can match it to your Facebook identity. So if you've ever given Facebook your phone number or your email, which you almost certainly have, Facebook can do a link with whatever, the list of stuff you've bought on Amazon. And Amazon can then target and find you on Facebook. So So the creepiness comes in. It's not what you said on Facebook. Like, all these stories about listening to your microphone is, by the way, technically, practically impossible and is absolutely not happening. But the reason why people think it is because they're being joined to a world of data. It's like, oh, I had a conversation with my girlfriend about cat food and I saw cat food. It's like, no, you literally just bought some on Amazon. You just don't realize it. Or you went to Safeway and your Safeway card. And there's all these other inputs. In fact, NPR did a story about it in which they actually examined almost all of these stories. And there was almost always some other avenue to which Facebook had joined that data. So that's really how the weird hyper-targeting stuff works. And in that Wired PC site about psychographics, on the political side, what they do is what's called the voter file. And the voter file is public information. Both sides do it, Republicans and Democrats, in which they compile data keyed to, if you've ever made political donations, et cetera, and then they target you based on that, right? I mean, whatever you think about that, that is definitely a real thing. It's not Cambridge Analytica hocus pocus, and they try to target you based on that. To the extent your data on Facebook does get used to target you, there's one aspect of Facebook's ad system which is super successful and nobody talks about. It's called lookalike targeting. And what that means is, and now we're getting a little wonky, I'll shut up after this in case your audience is falling asleep, but one of the biggest problems that retailers have, if you ever talk to like a big smart retailer like Netflix, Uber, Home Depot, whatever, right? They're like, okay, I've got this set of million people that I know have spent more than $400 in the past year or whatever, right? Like, I know how to reach them. I can retarget them on Google, on Facebook, on Snap, everything, right? What I need you to do is find me another 2 million people just like those people, right? And so what Facebook does, based on, like, say you and I are friends on Facebook and we're like chatting every day, then Facebook knows that you and I are very similar in some ways or another. Not in every aspect, probably, but if you're one of these million, for example, then potentially the ad that would have gotten targeted to you, they also target to me because they know that we're close in sort of the social graph. And that means that hopefully it's also the case that, you know, I would buy whatever you're in the process of buying.
I mean, I think the impression that I got when this story broke was that you were frustrated by a couple of things in the coverage of this, that A, people didn't realize how commonplace some of this technology was. B, they were kind of overhyping its effectiveness. But what was the reaction when you wrote about this back then? And, you know, did you get any blowback from people at the Times or other places like that?
No, they wouldn't deign. You know, when a peasant screams at the queen doesn't even notice the peasant. I mean, right. Of course, nobody at the New York Times noticed. Well, some of the writers did. I mean, I used to, so back in my even less cynical stage than now, I used to, part of the reason why I left writing, so I used to be like a full-time, very online person and writing and all this stuff. And I kind of left it all because I didn't feel I was changing anything, right? I was like screaming into a tornado. And I guess, you know, the recent news and part of the reason I'm probably on your show, right, is because the ICO report came out in the UK that more or less confirmed everything I just said. I was just reading the Financial Times story and it's basically debunking psychographics, calling it, you know, standard techniques that have been used in the industry since forever, which is true and all the rest of it. So, you know, it felt like, yeah, I was screaming at a mob, but nobody cared. I mean, one of the leading cheerleaders of the story, this woman, Carol, I'm going to mispronounce her last name, so I won't even attempt it.
The British yeah, Rachel Maddow, basically.
You made that analogy, not me, Matt, but okay. Sure. Yeah. I won't contradict it. You know, won all these journalism awards for all these allegations that recently have been shown to be completely false, right? Or mostly, or at least partly false and mostly overhyped. And so, yeah, it just felt like it's odd the turn that the media has taken against tech. And again, I criticize tech and Chaos Monkeys in many ways, right? Like, I'm not the super cheerleader, but I think the avenues of attack they've taken just seems so basic and just wrong and a little bit elementary that it just kind of pisses me off. And eventually I got so pissed off, I just went back to tech. Like as it is right now, I have a day job. Like I write occasionally, but not really. And so I'm just back in the machine where I started.
One of the things that I really loved about Chaos Monkeys, and I thought it was really interesting and would be worth talking about, because it gets to this idea that sort of misapprehensions that people might have about this world. You talked about Facebook, and you compared it to, you sort of dispelled the idea that these people were driven by greed. You said essentially that it was worse than that, because they you know, they really, 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 really want to make the world a better place, and simultaneously basically want everybody on Earth looking at a Facebook screen.
That's right.
So it's a combination of being subsumed in this corporate culture that is trying to achieve this end, but also there's like a belief element in there that's maybe different from other types of commercial experiences. Can you talk about that a little bit? Or
yeah, that's exactly right. I again, another misconception I think of Facebook is that it's all about greed or making money. When Facebook filed to go public, I was there at the time, and their S1, Zuck had a line there about how we don't build services to make money. We make money to build services, right? And like somehow nobody believed it. And yet that's actually how it works. Like working in ads is not the cool job at Facebook. And it's not the cool job at Google either, by the way. Like it's a necessary evil. And I came from the ads world, so whatever. But it nobody really thinks about it. Zuck doesn't understand. I mean, it's clear from his congressional testimony, he still doesn't understand the ads world in any serious way.
Really?
Oh yeah, no. He doesn't, I mean, the opening, I hate referring to my book again and again, but it's relevant here. The opening prologue of my book is me pitching this whole micro-targeting, hyper-targeting idea, which at the time was a revolutionary concept at Facebook. Facebook did not do it at all, right? And so we were pitching this winger only because the IPO was kind of on the horizon and Facebook's revenue wasn't growing fast enough. And so the call went out, like, come up with kooky ideas. And I, who had spent a little bit of time, not even that much time in the ad tech world, said, hey, you know, there's this whole retargeting, real-time bidding, all this programmatic stuff we could do. And he basically said yes. And I don't think he ever really fully understood what he was saying yes to. And to this day, I'm sure he doesn't understand how the data flows work inside the ad system, for example.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Was this the moment when they took their gloves off on the likes and decided to?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, they started using, well, the one thing he said no to was using the like button for ads targeting, but they later changed that decision. A couple years later after I left, so now the like button might actually be used for ads targeting. That's the one thing, because at the time, remember, Facebook platform was a big deal, right? This was still back in the day of like trying to get you to use Facebook to log into everything. So he didn't want the like button to be perceived as like the big brother that was following you around. So he said yes to everything else though, joining to the outside world of data, having a real-time system that would sync from, like say you go to an e-commerce site, right? That actually pings Facebook and then joins your Facebook user ID to that website. And so if you're shopping for this particular product, you're gonna see an ad for it within seconds on Facebook. Like that whole machinery didn't used to exist on Facebook before like 2012, 13. And so the book opened with me pitching that idea, which again, was not radical for the ad tech world, but was radical for Facebook. But again, getting back to your original question, right? Like Facebook, at least at the time, right? And I think it's changed a little bit given the number of leaks you see coming out of the company. But at the time, at least, it was super mission driven. And the goal was really to become, the New York Times of you, your personal social newspaper. I'm quoting the sort of rallying speech that Chris Cox, who was formerly head of product, and I think he went back recently to Facebook, was giving us the new hires on our onboarding, which at the time, like even me, who was pretty bullish on Facebook, was like, oh, come on, man, that's never going to happen. And yet, you know, here we are, right? And so that vision has fired them since the very earliest days. And that's, at the high levels, at least, what they're really about. The New York Times of you. And as I say, like, that's actually, like, greed is like very basic, right? A greedy person is rational and kind of like, right, at the end of the day, isn't actually that scary, at least to me, not that scary, right? But a prophet of a religion who wants to refactor society in a certain way, that's way scarier, right? Because so you have no idea what they're willing to do. Yeah.
So they're more missionary than mercenary.
That's an excellent way to put it. Yes, that's right. Yes.
They're like neocons almost. No, like they really believe that. I guess there's a big debate over whether or not like Dick Cheney cared about KBR Root and Halliburton contracts more than he cared about spreading democracy. Anyway.
I think Rumsfeld who cared democracy. About the spreading democracy.
Okay, yeah.
By the way, we're dating ourselves such an Xers. Nobody understands nobody younger than 30 understands what the fuck we're talking about, by the way.
Okay, so, you know, Adam
history
McKay.
Started with 9/11.
check out the Adam McKay movie, Vice.
Okay.
Or maybe I'm dating myself with that reference too.
So what did Zuck say in the testimony that had you scratching your head about his understanding of ads?
I mean, he basically punted on a lot of the details. I mean, the senator's questions weren't particularly good either, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not just in the testimony. A lot of his quoted statements, right? Like whenever the few times that he gets asked detailed questions about how ad tech works, I mean, you can tell he doesn't understand the deep machinery, which is fine. But mm-hmm. but again, I think getting back to the issue of being missionary versus mercenary, right? I think one of the things that you can rightly criticize Silicon Valley for, and again, I think there's a number of angles that one can rightly criticize Silicon Valley, is they've got this dewy-eyed techno-optimism, right? Which I call one of the necessary delusions of Silicon Valley. Like, I think there are a lot of delusions that reign supreme in Silicon Valley. And I think they need to exist for this unique Silicon Valley world to exist. And one of them is that they only ever see the positive side. A, they're almost all like middle to upper middle class Americans, right? Which implies a certain assumptions about the state of the world, right? Like you don't launch a social network and think, oh, this could be used for ethnic genocide one day, because of course that's just not part of your worldview. You don't understand that as part of a thing that can happen with the internet, right?
And so it also informs their political ideas, because they come from a starting place where everybody they know is a certain kind of person. Never mind.
Yes. I think some of those allegations are right. And then again, part of that optimism is that they just never imagine the negative sides of a lot of what they do. Mind you, I think the media side also tends to overstress the negative. Like I think, you know, everything from the teachers union strikes in whatever Midwestern country, states it was in like 2014-15, right? We're all organized via Facebook groups. I own property in a small rural community, and all the local gossip and communication and all that happens through Facebook groups. So like there's a lot of positive too. Like again, I think both sides are kind of overstressing it. But I definitely think the techies just sometimes don't have, I think, I wouldn't say it's the worldliness because that makes them seem like provincials, but I think they just don't have sometimes the sort of full scope to understand what the impact of their technology is. And the thing is, if they had that, they would never do what they're doing, right? And that, I think, is one of the weird paradoxes that, like, Silicon Valley can't be what it is if you're sitting there thinking about what's going to be the impact of Uber on the Parisian taxi market, right? Like, it's probably roiling it. I'm sure there's terrible shit happening in Paris, but you Silicon Valley wouldn't exist if you actually thought about every negative externality.
So they're out of touch?
To a certain degree, yes. I would think so, yes.
What are those negative things? Like, what are the things that they overlook that you think that would inform their decisions? Anything in particular?
I'll cite a concrete example. So I think I mentioned when we were warming up before this that in 2014 I moved to Europe. I'm a Spanish citizen. I lived in Barcelona for a while. Barcelona, beautiful city. The sort of downtown or medieval part of Barcelona has basically been ruined by Airbnb. I mean, what the nationalist troops in the Spanish Civil War couldn't quite manage to do during the siege, right? Airbnb actually managed to do in a couple of years, because basically every old building has become effectively an Airbnb hotel. As I understand it, Barcelona at the time was Airbnb's biggest market in Europe. And so almost every apartment, I mean, think about it, right? Like a lot of these were crumbling or like not super high-end apartments in kind of the old part of town, but you could book them out for $100 a night or whatever to English, Swedish, American tourists, et cetera. And of course everybody did. And so I was living in a building in which I think basically every apartment save one was a constantly changing sort of parade of European tourists. And a lot of the holdouts who lived there had seen their neighborhoods transformed in this bizarre Disneyland-esque ways. In fact, they'd put banners on their balconies complaining about it. And I think that's one of those things that if you're in the mind of, I don't know him or anything, but in the mind of Brian Chesky, right, the CEO of Airbnb, this is something that I'm sure didn't enter his mind at all until Airbnb just got to a certain scale. So,
yeah. Do you think that's the ghost of Franco? Is in
well, yeah. If I was a New York Times reporter, yes, I would say Airbnb is basically the equivalent of Spanish fascism. That's right. That's exactly what it is.
Do you think that they become mercenary? Like, do you think that the greed stuff takes over, like subconsciously? Or I mean, I know this is requiring some kind of psychoanalysis, but do you think that when you're doing it for long enough, you become kind of like indifferent to the real world consequences, and it becomes
or you generate excuses for what you're doing subconsciously.
Yeah, you know, I left Facebook about a year after the IPO, and things were getting a little bit more corporate-y and public company thing there, and you know, obviously the quarterly revenue number was getting to be kind of a big deal. So I'm not sure. I've never been in a late stage employee. By late, I mean like considerably after the IPO and a lot of these companies. I'm not sure. I do know, one thing I mentioned in the book is that geography at Facebook kind of mattered, and where your desks were relative to like where Zuck was, right? Because it was a very sort of imperial company. How close you were to the throne room basically mattered, right?
Like literally, right?
Literally, yeah, like physically, yeah, yeah. Like Ads was not even in the same building as Zuck in the new campus, right? Which was, I think, symbolic in a way. But as I understand it later, as Ads got into Feed and all the rest of it, Ads people were actually sitting close to Zuck. So in fact, as you're suggesting, it may well have changed at Facebook. I'm really not sure, to be honest.
I don't want to get into this too much because, you know, it's probably a different subject for a different time, but the whole missionary issue with companies like Facebook and Google, how concerning is it or could it be? Because they really traditionally didn't have much interest in content moderation or right. censorship or any of that stuff. And it feels to me from the outside like that what's happening is that they're being pressured to take on more of that responsibility, and that missionary component to these companies is starting to kick into gear with that activity now, right? Like, I was just wondering if you could speak to A, the logistical challenges involved right. in trying to deal with that much content in any kind of rational way, and right. and B, what could go right and wrong with these efforts.
Right, right. So my direct experience here is somewhat limited, although it's not zero. One of the odd things, so the Facebook ads team was very small for a long time, right? Like when I joined, it was maybe 25 engineers and 6 product managers. This is as late as 2011. So it's not a very big team. And somewhat randomly, I was put in charge of what was then called ads quality. Now it's called ads integrity or some sort of euphemism. Basically, it's the ads police that make sure that you're not uploading nudity or whatever, you know, things that violate Facebook's ad content. So I was never on the consumer side of sort of policing user content, but I was on the sort of commercial side of policing ads content. And there the philosophy was very similar, right? You had a relatively small set of human reviewers, and you tried to build technology that would let them very quickly sort of review and enforce Facebook's policies. And then you'd use technology to either bubble up things that should be policed or disseminate those decisions more universally. So for example, if one image was shown to violate policy, you would take every version of that image and never allow it in the ad system again, right? You try to build this sort of software human hybrid that, minimizing the number of humans used, still let you police millions and millions of pieces of content, right? So that by and large is the philosophy of all these companies, not just Facebook. Like that's the way it has to work. Historically, before this whole 2016 media cycle, Facebook did police user content because it did enforce, obviously, its own policies around pornography, violent content, etc. If you note that you go to your Facebook feed and that it's not littered with pornography or violent beheading videos, it's because there's a massive user ops team at Facebook that actually polices that content. Of course, the challenge there, I think, right, with this new push towards content moderation is that, look, nobody wants to see porn or a beheading video in their Facebook experience, right? Like 99% plus of users just do not want to see that shit in their feed, right? Like it's, and then also, you know, like the classic thing, like it's hard to define pornography, but you know right. it when you see it, right? Like right. it's actually not that ambiguous to filter out extreme violence or pornography, right? right? And so enforcing that policy is A, relatively smaller in scale. Like there isn't that much porn on Facebook to be filtered. And two, it's unambiguous. Like it's clear what is pornography versus isn't. But when you get into issues of truth, right? Like what is right. truth? That is a whole different ball of wax, right? And I've said this story before. The first time I realized like, holy shit, this cycle is going to be different than everything else was Zuck's like post like 3 or 4 days after the 2016 election, in which he basically hinted that they would work with like, you know, Snopes or whatever, some fact-checking site to like help review content, which is the first suggestion Facebook has ever made in history, right? That it would actually be responsible for the content on its site. And from then, of course, that move has only increased, right? And I just remember thinking, oh my God, do they understand the road they're going down, right? Like this is gonna change everything in terms of Facebook. And it has. A couple years ago, probably the only down quarter or the only time that Facebook's share price went down after an earnings report was Zuck basically announcing we're investing heavily in content moderation and you know, hiring whatever it was, 10 or 15,000 reviewers. They actually compressed their profit margins. Facebook historically had a gross profit margin of something like 30%. So in other words, you know, $1 billion comes in, right? And they keep 30% of that. They actually compressed that down to like Google levels, around 20 some odd percent, all of it to pay for this huge army of contractors or employees to review all this content. So I think those are the challenges, right? And if you wonder, like, why doesn't, so a couple things. One, it's hard to manage humans, right? And Facebook is fundamentally an engineering company. It doesn't want to be an operational company. Two, and here's one thing that I think also outsiders have a hard time getting their head around, even people who are academics or experts who study it. The scale of Facebook, if you've not been at Facebook and opened the Facebook dashboard and seen that every number is denominated in billions, like everything, right? Like just how many zeros are behind any phenomenon, I don't think you understand quite how daunting that is. BuzzFeed, Ryan Mack at BuzzFeed had a story recently, of course, anti-Facebook, but if you read between the lines, I think it was really good. It was about an insider, a data scientist actually at Facebook who took it upon herself to take a role in moderating content. And I think it's, I mean, the piece is obviously written super anti, but I think it's a great look into what it's like at Facebook and reminded me of my time there as well, where like, here's this one individual, she's relatively early in her career, like she's not like a senior person at Facebook, okay? And she's like having the last word on, I think it was El Salvador. The presidential election in El Salvador was coming down to some relatively junior or mid-level employee at Facebook to police, right? And that, like, and the El Salvadorian election is like this rounding error on the, like, not even a rounding error on the global dashboard when it comes to engagement, right? And that is, and you might think, well, you know what? It's unfair that one company should have so much influence everywhere from the Ukraine to El Salvador. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you. But the reality is, if you're saying Facebook should have a level of oversight that the New York Times, say, does over its own content and every market in that it's in, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to break it to you. That is just not possible, right? No company in the world has the resources and the manpower to actually do that. And it's simple, and artificial intelligence is not going to catch up in time. And it's literally just not possible.
So there are going to, inevitably, there are going to be either overreaches, mistakes, or right. what's going to happen if they, I mean, they already are doing it. But what's the consequence going to be if they?
I mean, this is getting a little, you know, prophetic and a little like, you know, philosophy major after the third bong hit. But, you know, I think like the piece I'm working on for my Substack, I still write as a hobby because I just can't manage to not write, is about how the media world, and I think we're entering this sort of media medievalism that I think the notion of there being a public forum with some common notion of truth that we can all agree on is just not going to exist anymore, right? Mm. And that's fine, right? People can go on Substack and write what they want, or the New York Times, which is mostly subscriber-based now rather than ads-based, can, you know, tend to its audience and give it the content that they want. But I think organizations or entities, whether it's the US government or Facebook, that span the growing political polarization will find themselves in an impossible position, right? They will never, it's look at one of the bizarre paradoxes. The conservative right-wing world thinks that Facebook is out to get them. But if you actually look at the engagement numbers, Fox and Ben Shapiro and whatnot completely dominate Facebook, right? Like somebody like Ben Shapiro gets more engagement on Facebook than like a major news network, right? And so, you know, if Facebook has it in for conservatives, they're really doing a bad job of it. Because if you look at, as Kevin Roos at the New York Times constantly reminds us, because he's constantly tweeting about it, like the top 10 most engaged posts are usually right-wing media outlets, right? And so, and yet the conservatives think that Facebook is out to get them, right? And so I think it's, they will never be able to satisfy everyone, particularly in a world in which our, not just our media world, our entire epistemic universes about what happens in the world are now diverging into various groups. So
And what about, there's like a discussion about whether or not Facebook should like censor or comment moderate at all. But then on the other side is the reality apparently that it's not that they're people who are demanding certain activity from or intervention from Facebook. It's not that they're saying that Facebook shouldn't be neutral or hands off. They're saying that they have these algorithms, and sorry, because I'm so ignorant about this, but right. There's a criticism that they have algorithms that amplify or favor certain things. So, right. And that the demand from some people is that Facebook not do that, as opposed to I think some people think that there are two options, right? It's like Facebook not doing anything and being totally neutral, or being very interventionist, and really they are being interventionist.
I think you framed it the right way, right? There is indeed a spectrum between like absolute freedom of speech, you know, minus pornography and crazy violence that we all agree on shouldn't be there, and you know, having the same level of ownership that the New York Times editorial board does with their op-ed, right? And we're on a spectrum, and we're really fighting about where on the spectrum we are. I think you also raised the excellent point about the algorithmic side of things. So people's eyes tend to glaze over when you mention an algorithm. It really is just a model that says, is a user likely to engage with this piece of content? Like, don't worry about the details. The point is, it's a mathematical thing. It runs and says, you've got a 3% chance to interact with this thing and a 2% chance of this thing. It sorts it by that and gives you the top 100 or whatever, right? Like, that's, at the end of the day, that's what it is. And then the question is, you know, are some of the inputs to that model things like virality, right? The fact that, for example, this is the gross simplification, but one feature of the model could be, oh, the speed of engagement, like the number of likes it's gotten over the past 5 minutes. If that were a feature of the model, then stuff like just to cite a name, Alex Jones and with his crazy content, right? If that goes super viral, then that will do well on Facebook, kind of disproportionate with potentially the worth of Alex Jones's content, right? And so I don't think it's crazy to actually say, you know what, Facebook, you should maybe put the brakes on the virality side such that you don't incentivize people to actually come up with super clickbaity viral content. And from what I understand, and again, it's hard to tell from the outside because A, it's complicated, and two, they're not very transparent, which is another thing I think Facebook could be more of, frankly. But supposedly they've taken measures to actually reduce the number of sort of viral inputs to their algorithm such that more extremist content does poorly. But again, from the outside world, it's very hard to judge how effective any of that's been. But I think that's a perfectly legitimate case to be made to Facebook.
And did you read Evan Greer's piece at Wired? A political ad ban won't fix Facebook's election problem.
Oh, you know, I hate to say it, having written for Wired, that I didn't read a Wired piece, but
okay, I'll send it to you. I totally sprung that on you. The subtitle is "A Performative Post-Election Ban Won't Solve Anything, But Cutting Off the Platform's Data-Driven Rage Machine Will."
I haven't read the piece. Okay, so I don't want to mischaracterize what that guy said, but right. just to take on just what you said as a view which exists in the world, which is like, oh, they shouldn't be taking this data-driven approach. I mean, again, the scale is the one thing that I think is missing from how most people think about Facebook. Like, do you realize the union of all the content that all your friends on Facebook put out is like tens of thousands, if not more, of stuff every day? They're not going to just present it to you in chronological order. They obviously have to weight it to some degree. And so there's going to be some level of engagement-driven sorting that happens. That there's no question that needs to happen. And by the way, just to comment on one thing on Evan Greer, like, he's discounting the differential policing of political advertising. I think that's another place where I think there's a valid criticism of Facebook. Their policies around political content probably should be different than certainly around advertising content, which has precedence elsewhere. This isn't new, right? There's different standards around political advertising on TV, on radio, and everything, right, than there are on Facebook, because obviously trying to sell you on Trump versus Biden is somehow categorically more important than trying to sell you a pair of shoes, right? Mm-hmm. This is part of why I think, again, like, everyone freaks out about data and privacy and all the rest of it. 98% of the time, the machinery is just trying to sell you a pair of shoes. Like, who cares, right? But the cases where our national democracy depends on it, yes, I agree there. The company should probably actually have different rules and more scrutiny. For example, one thing, all this pressure on Facebook, I think a lot of it's been kind of noise. Some of the pressure, I think, has resulted in good things. Facebook has what's called the Facebook Ad Archive, which is, I encourage your listeners to go check it out. Just Google Facebook Ad Archive. It's like this searchable thing. It's an unprecedented level of transparency. Like, nobody else does this. Google, like, no other big ad network does this. But you can go and say, I want to see all the ads that Trump is running in this state or whatever. You can just go and see, and like, what content is this dude running? And it's kind of amazing. And I think in the political world, that's definitely a welcome level of transparency.
It's kind of a broad question, but there are a lot of people who think that Facebook has grown to such enormous dimensions and now has such awesome power, somewhat accidentally, right? Like, it wasn't their intention to grow into what it's become, that it's become something like a utility. Do you agree with that at all? Or do you think that there are any parts of this universe that should be regulated in a different way? Or
So it's funny. I mean, I think that argument is basically true, but it's funny how different people will cite it to forward different arguments. Right. I think Facebook, if you talk to a lot of Facebook people, or former me, whatever, I do think Facebook has become kind of a utility, like a platform. But those people would say, well, it's a platform, right? It's like the email system or the phone system, right? Like, when you get a marketing call, you don't blame AT&T. When you get a spam email, you typically don't blame Gmail. You blame the sender, right? And right. Facebook is just a machine for sending messages. So that's one side of that argument. The other side, which is probably what you're driving at, is like, well, utilities are regulated, so Facebook should be regulated like a utility. I find that, I think, if you look at the history of social media regulation or data regulation like the GDPR in Europe, and that's a whole rabbit hole we don't need to go down, but I think it's been largely ineffective. And if anything, it's just warped the market to actually benefit incumbents in a big way. And so I get really wary when people in DC are trying to regulate companies that they absolutely do not understand in any way, shape, or form. That said, I think one avenue, if you want to call it regulation or control, whatever, antitrust, I think is one avenue that maybe is not that crazy. I actually wrote a piece once arguing that, you know, splitting up Facebook into Instagram, WhatsApp, and Facebook is maybe not a terrible idea. I don't think it's going to happen under current antitrust precedent, but if you imagine a different world of antitrust, there's no obvious reason why WhatsApp should be owned by Facebook. There's no obvious consumer benefit that comes out of it. There's a lot of benefits to Facebook, and we can get into what those are. But other than like a very hegemonic bid for control of the media markets, it's not clear why Facebook should own these companies. So right. I can see an antitrust argument against Facebook.
I mean, I guess that's what I was concerned about. Because when they had all those hearings, especially a couple of years ago, it felt like every member of the Senate on both parties, frankly, they were not terribly interested in the antitrust argument. They were much more interested in finding a way to keep Facebook as it is, but make sure that its power was going in the right direction, right? Like, that's what I worry about, is that I think what you're talking about with, you know, regulation helping incumbents, that's my worry, right? Is that yeah. it's going to be regulated in a way that is going to work in conjunction with, you know, the powers that be, or whoever the sitting government happens to be. I mean, is that a fear that people should have, or?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I mean, just to use GDPR as an example, GDPR places these fairly onerous constraints on what you can or can't do with data. And the reality is that given all that overhead, larger companies can handle it a lot better. And then if you're an advertiser, you tend to trust larger companies to be GDPR compliant better. And so the fraction of budgets that Facebook and Google have made up, by many reports, have actually gone up under a GDPR world, and smaller media companies and the third party ecosystem has been basically destroyed by it. I mean, here's one of the weird trade-offs that I think most people don't realize. I think people in the industry totally realize it. People outside don't. There's a trade-off between sort of privacy and monopoly power, or privacy and antitrust, right? Like, you can impose harsh privacy constraints around uses of data and regulation, all the rest of it, but that will necessarily tend towards agglomeration of that power within a smaller number of large companies. Or you could say, look, there's going to be a third-party ecosystem. Data is going to circulate more freely. Google and Facebook have more competition, but yes, indeed, there are more privacy issues. Look, there's sketchy shit that happens in the ad tech world. No one would deny it. And if you allow small third parties to buy and sell your data, as many do, in fact, then you're going to get into privacy issues as well. Yeah, but again, I think the level of the conversation is like not even remotely there yet. Like, people are still talking about whether like Zuck listens to you like through your phones and like records your conversation. Right. It's like, dude, we need to be like 10 years ahead of this. And I think, just as a final thing, like, it just seems to me like this business of wiring up everyone's brain to one of these, to a smartphone, right? Like, literally everyone from like a taxi driver in Bangalore to a farmer in Brazil to some hipster in San Francisco have instant communication, right? Like, this is literally global telepathy in your pocket, right? That the realities of that, I think, are just so disruptive to just society as we know it. Like, the whys and wherefores of like Cambridge Analytica, or, you know, some little tweak to the political rules around Facebook are not going to change any of that. And we as a society need to start thinking about what does it mean when all of humanity can talk to itself in effectively an unfiltered way. And I don't think we're having that conversation. I think if you look at almost every part of the political spectrum, the only thing that distinguishes them is what year they want to return to. Like, what year do they think society should be rewinded to, right? Like, the MAGA people think it's like, oh, 1958. And like, you know, the Obama people are like, no, 2008. Like, everyone just wants to return. And nobody seems to have anything like a vision for the future, which
is coming no matter what anyway.
Which is coming no matter what, exactly.
Right, that's why we got to build back better.
That's the Biden phrase, right? Yeah. I saw that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, really. Not just Biden, it's all over the place, apparently.
Yeah.
But Boris Johnson.
What do you have to say about, I mean, so much of the discourse around elections and interference is based on what the Russians did on Facebook. Oh,
yeah.
And it seems like, I don't know if you have any access to this information, but it seems like there's a big conflation between the Russian government and Russian business people.
Troll farms or whatever.
Troll farms, yeah. Do you have any insight into that? Or
Well, I'm not a very good criminologist. What I do have insight into, and I've gotten into fights about with a friend of mine like Renee DiResta, who's a big voice in this whole misinformation thing. She works at the Stanford Research Lab. The whole Russia Internet Research Agency thing, right? The problem there, like without any question, they obviously intervene and try to use Facebook groups to influence the election. Like that's just documented. But what I doubt is the efficacy of all that, right? Like what's come out at least is they spent $100,000 on ads, which is nothing. That's like whistling into the wind, into a tornado when it comes to Facebook. And then if you look at the actual numbers, like the number of pages, the number of likes, like again, if you take all that, like think about for a marketer, right? You take human activity and then you divide it by like either the number of total pieces of content or the number of ad impressions or the number of whatever. If you divide it by that, that's your ratio that you care about. That divisor in the case of Facebook is billions and billions and billions, right? So for Russia to have thrown the election in a 330 plus million person country would have required a media tidal wave like no other, right? Like if these people can claim to throw the election with 100K in ad spend, they should stop dicking around to Russia and start an ad agency and come to the United States, because that's incredible, right? like, and in fact, the Russians, the best 100K they spent was convincing somehow the US media establishment that 100K can actually win an election. I find the whole thing, I mean, it is alarming. Like, I think going forward, obviously countries are going to use this for misinformation as they've used every other means in the past, right? Russia used to have, you know, radio stations that would transmit to the US, right, and all this stuff, right? Like this is just a continuation of war by different means. So I'm skeptical of the Russia story just because, again, they were doing it. I don't know how efficacious it actually was, right, in the global scheme of things.
So they didn't create racism and start Black Lives Matter over Facebook? They didn't. Hey man, sorry.
Jesus memes. I'm telling you, Jesus memes.
Jesus masturbation memes. Now that's the killer combo. What masturbation memes alone, Jesus memes alone, not so much. But you put them together.
We can beat it together.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the.
Yeah. Feeling down, Jesus can. Let's beat it together. Yeah.
I don't want to imagine what that meme even looks like. Okay.
I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you with the trigger warning. It's not graphic at all, which is why I was able to be on Facebook, of course.
Excellent. All right, Antonio, cool. Thanks so much. We've already run over time-wise,
thank you.
And we'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Cool. Yeah.
All right.
Bye. Take care.
All right, that was interesting.
Very interesting. Knows a lot.
Knows a lot about a lot of stuff.
Cares a lot.
Yeah, and you know, I think one point that I think is worth taking away from that conversation is that people are hyper-focused on things that they want to happen in this new kind of information-dominated landscape, and nobody's really embracing the fact of what's happening, which is that this new technology that so completely dominates our lives, maybe dominates the wrong word, that is, you know, that's involved with our lives at so many different levels. People just haven't wrapped their heads around how enormous that change is and what it means. And I think they keep wanting to put certain kinds of band-aids on it and not face it. And I thought that was an interesting point that he was making.
Also, the Russia stuff keeps popping up. I have a question. What I feel almost pressured to not talk about this until after the election. But it's really hard because there's just like myth after myth after myth coming out and being regurgitated about the role of the Russians. And are we going to have to just do a kind of a post-election post-mortem on this? Because do you think it functions too much as a Trump exonerating tool right now, or Trump justifying, or the Hunter Biden thing too?
Yeah, we've both talked about this for over a year now. The you know, these stories, which are primarily coming from people who work inside the security services or who work in these think tanks that, you know, have some kind of an interest in playing up the Russian threat. You know, they drive these news stories. Reporters love them because they're sexy and because they're politically useful, and I think the Democratic Party likes it also because it plants the seed for an explanation if things should go wrong. I hate these stories. They're just too many of them to individually knock down
debunk,
each time.
Yeah.
And so Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to talk about it at this point. It's exhausting. You know, I am going to try to count literally all of the screwed up news stories from the last 4 years, but it's just happening now at such a fast pace that it's tough to keep track of.
And then people are going to be like, "Why are you talking about this now? We should be focusing on the election." Can we just talk about the basic? I don't know if this is easy in like a minute, a lightning round, like the basic things that people keep saying that aren't true. Like no one paid attention to that CrowdStrike piece. The one that Aaron Mate came on to talk about where he, you know, where Adam Schiff got that guy to say that there was no evidence of exfiltration.
Yeah, not direct evidence.
Right? Not direct evidence. It was circumstantial evidence. Or the Julian Assange thing. I mean, that's something that's insane.
Or people always say you're defending Putin. No, well, no, actually, it has nothing to do with Putin. He's irrelevant to the whole situation. And this is about... how much we're saying that Russians are impacting our lives. And if we're saying that they are it more than they really are, then that's just not correct. It's not a positive reflection on Vladimir Putin. That's not defending him. That's just talking about this. But it's become impossible
to even talk about it.
To talk about it.
Yeah.
And when they do kind of fizzle out, they fizzle out on page 11 after having been on page one.
Right.
You know, like the Russian bounty story, which I think was a story that was designed to make sure that certain budgetary measures were passed. You know, it was in the news for 2 weeks, and then, you know, a month later, they say, "Oh yeah, we don't actually have evidence for that," but whatever.
Right. But Kamala still brought it up in the debate.
Yeah, of course, because the line between what is true and what's, you know, proven and not proven just gets blurrier and blurrier all the time. So for some people, this is real. It just is real. There's nothing you can say.
Right, you can't say anything. And just really quickly, so we had Nadia on from Pussy Riot, and this is a woman who was imprisoned by Putin. Like, she's not a Putin fan at all. And even she was like, Putin doesn't have the power that people are saying he has. And Masha Gessen, also not a Putin fan, but was saying how useful it is for
Putin. He loves this.
He loves this. Like, what a great, what? That's the irony. You guys are giving Putin the free PR. You guys who think he's evil. Like, this is great for him to look like he's interfering with elections. And, you know.
Yeah, you know, and as Antonio talked about, the numbers last time around were... And you know, they turned that $100,000 worth of ads, and they used the trick. They said, you know, that it, up to 126 million people saw those ads, but obviously it wasn't that many,
right?
You know, and that amount of money. Anyway,
also some of them came out after the elections.
Some of them came out after the elections. A lot of them came out in states that were safe states for Democrats, where relatively small amounts came out in Michigan and Wisconsin. If you actually looked at it, it's clear that it's totally stupid, but it doesn't matter. You know, for a lot of people, it's true, and it's always going to be true. So,
yeah.
You know, we're heading down the home stretch. I'm sure there's going to be lots more to talk about next week, and we'll get to that. So until then, rate and review us, buy merch, and we'll see you next week.
Great.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.